We're continuing our sermon series that officially started last week, but unofficially started 2 weeks ago because this has been kind of unfolding. I had the idea for this sermon series just in a basic, I wanted to do a sermon series, a message series, a teaching series on the book of Ephesians, but it didn't have a firm idea of how that would all unfold, and so I started kind of doing a deep dive into it myself in my personal life, and alongside this idea of studying Ephesians and wanting to and asking God, like, how do you want me to present this as a cohesive unit? What is the central core of this book? I also started getting this other feeling of this idea of identity, and they kind of merged together, this concept of who am I and who does God say that I am? Because that question of who am I is one that I think everyone asks, whether you mean to or not, whether you know it or not, we all ask it. And sometimes we answer the question, but sometimes, oftentimes, a lot of the time, maybe even most of the time, somebody else answers it for us. And it starts right away. It starts with even your birth order has an impact on your identity. As a firstborn, there were certain things that I would experience that my younger siblings wouldn't, especially if you had a stricter upbringing and the youngest sibling who's 16 years younger than you has it good. If you're the oldest, you know the fight. If you're the middleborn, then you know the struggle of not being the oldest and not being the baby, and you know how that impacted your identity. If you were the baby of the family, I roll my eyes at you, you have it easy, I have no sympathy for you. But that made a difference in who you are, and how you were brought up, and how you see yourself, and how you interacted with your siblings. Your birth order impacted you. Your personality very early on started to get you identified. Were you the funny kid? Were you the awkward kid? Did you walk early? Did you speak early? Did you develop athletic skills at young ages? It's amazing how younger and younger kids seem to be pegged as athletes now. Hockey is my sport of choice, and seeing like 5-year-olds playing hockey and skating far better than I can is incredible. But from these young ages, you can start to get this identity formed of I am the athletic one, or I'm the non-athletic one, I'm the chubby one. It may even be the artsy one, or you're the nerdy one. Who were you, and who were you going to be? And of course, other people influenced your identity. Even just your name mattered. What name were you given? Because for some people, just the name their parents gave them has impacted them for better or for worse. Some of us have odd spelling of our names, and we curse our mother every time somebody misspells it. Some of us have weird last names. I guarantee most of you are going to misspell Pastor Franklin's last name, mostly because I know most of you misspell my last name. So you've got a double whammy of pastors with hard-to-spell last names. But that influences you, nicknames that you're given, the way people refer to you or describe you, impact your identity, and it helps to form who you are. And as we continue through life, we hit our teenage years, and things become incredibly complicated. You hit middle school, and you have no idea who you are. You go from being the top dog in elementary school to now being at the lowest end of the totem pole. You develop new relationships and new responsibilities and new authorities. And they're all giving you input on who you are, or at least who they think you should be. For some kids, clothes become more and more important, how people see you. Some of these kids are wearing makeup now. They are very, very aware of how they look, and oftentimes how you look becomes your identity in and of itself. We start to invest in beauty products, not just the girls, but the guys too. And the rest of us, we struggle in that phase because have we hit our growth spurt yet? Are we the short one? Are we the tall one? Are we the lanky or the muscular one? All of these questions come together to help determine our identity, and it continues through high school, and you fall into a pattern of being who others tell you to be, whether you're falling in line with expectations of adults, leaders in your life, whether you're falling in line with expectations of your peers. Whatever the influences are, you have pretty well developed that pattern, and then you hit college, and all of a sudden you're given this opportunity to reinvent yourself, to become who you really are. And for some of us, that looks completely different than who we used to be. I know for many people, when you go away for college especially, it becomes very, very easy to make some of these decisions of who will I be? What will my life look like? Both in spiritual matters, in personal conduct matters, you have to ask, and you're almost forced, whether you realize it or not, are forced to ask that question of who am I going to become? And then you graduate, whether it's from college, university, whether you enter the military, or even just getting a job right at a school, questions start to pop up about the kind of adult you're going to be now that you have real responsibilities. And again, you have this mini identity crisis where you have to ask things like, where will I work? Will I get a job in my field? How will I find that job? Where will I live? Will I make enough money? What will I drive? How will I pay my bills? Will I be in a relationship or will I be single forever? And then perhaps you get the job that you want, or at least the job that you find, and then that becomes your identity. And you get married, and that becomes your identity, and people are continually having to reassess and reevaluate. And for some people, they have these mini identity crises on this cycle of every 4 or 5 years. You get married, you have kids, and your life begins to revolve around that. For years and years and years, you invest in your kids because they're your life now, and rightfully so. And then some people, they get into their 50s, maybe their 60s, and they have what we call a midlife crisis. And some people, and I don't know why, it seems like a men thing, go and buy the red sports car, and they dye their hair and think nobody will notice. And they sometimes will try to trade in their relationship for a newer model, and they'll try to become... Is everyone looking at Warren? Because that's not what I was trying to get at. Oh, I'm the lead pastor? I have the sign to prove it. It's on my door now. I'm in charge. Sit down, Warren. But this question, I don't, if this is the extent of his midlife crisis, we're okay. But over the years, we're continually confronted with this question of who am I? Who am I really? And sometimes this can even be something that lasts into your 60s and 70s, where you're still seeking who am I and who do I want to be? And for some people, they never quite figure it out. For some people, their identity is constantly in crisis, in conflict, and in chaos. And for many of us, and I mentioned this last week, for many of us, it leaves us with a distorted picture of who we really are. And this conversation on identity is so critical, because identity influences every area of your life. In fact, I would go so far as to say that who you are, your identity, dictates what you do. You can't be surprised when somebody acts out of their identity. If they see themselves as this, they're going to act like this. You cannot, maybe you can fault them, but you can't expect anything more. It is a critical discussion that needs to be had, because we as people need to make the determination of who am I and who do I want to be. For some of us, it's a terrifying question because we either don't know who we are or we don't like who we are. And you know, I've heard before that in a world now that is so loud and has so much to distract us, that we are losing our identities more than ever because we never are forced to be alone with ourselves. And if you're like a lot of people, you appreciate that because you don't want to sit in silence for fear of what your silence may scream. But the question that we rarely ask, when we ask who I am, and the opinion that we rarely seek, is God's opinion. Who does God say that I am? Yes, I can try to determine who I am and who I want to be, and of course, people all around us, governments, even schools, corporations, there's a cacophony, there's this deafening noise of people trying to tell us who we need to be and to fit us into a neat little box. But who does God say that I am? Because as you search the scriptures and you look for the answer to this question, you'll see that the scriptures paint a portrait of our identity that looks quite unlike the way I see myself. You know, if you are a typical person, there are elements of yourself that you don't like. And in fact, there may be more than just bits and pieces. You may genuinely not like yourself. Or you may have bought into a lie that you are something that God says that you are not. So when you hear about Jesus and the message of Christ and how he challenges your preconceived notions of who you are and who you can be, it takes a different tone and it challenges you to reevaluate yourself. In fact, a New Testament scholar named Kyle Snodgrass, which we can all laugh about his name, but you probably have a weird name too for some people. But he talks about the fact that Jesus' ministry, the entirety of his ministry, can be summed up in the challenge and the confrontation and rearranging of a person's thinking about identity. Everything that Jesus did revolves around this central concept of who are you and who does God say that you are. And he wants you to discover your true self, your real identity. He wants you to discover who you really are and allow it to impact every area of your life. And so as we continue in this series, we're going to continue to unpack who God is calling us to be and the implications it has on how we live, because you'll find that the tagline to this series is true: who you are defines what you do. And as we started last week, we're going to be spending a lot of time in the book of Ephesians, the letter that Paul wrote to the Turkish city of Ephesus, to a church that desperately was trying to figure out who they were in the middle of an ever-shifting culture. You may remember that Ephesus was a port city, a major Roman port city in Turkey that actually opened up into the Mediterranean. And it was well known as a rich culture. People made a lot of money on their location. And people boats would come through for trade. It would be the gateway to the empire. And so people made bank. There was also a huge amount of pagan worship that happened in Ephesus, particularly to the goddess Artemis. We mentioned this last week. It was the central hub of worship for this goddess. And so, again, another influence on the people's lives are being challenged here. People would have dedicated themselves to living out the glory of the Roman Empire, or at very least, they would have been heavily impacted as victims of the Roman Empire. Because we know empires rise on the backs of the lowest people. And in fact, if you've read the book of Ephesians, you know that it was developed and it was built on the backs of slaves. In fact, Paul even has some discussion about how you treat your slaves and how slaves within this church should act. People who had fallen prey to a vulturous society that didn't care about them and their needs, didn't care for the least of these, would have been present in this church. And so you would have had the rich alongside the poorest of the poor, both asking, how does the scriptures, how does the gospel impact me? And what difference does that make in how I see myself? Well, we're going to backtrack a little bit. Last week we were in Ephesians chapter 2, and we're going to jump into Ephesians chapter 1 together if you'd like to follow along in your Bibles or in the Bible app. It is in there. All of my notes are always there in the Bible app pretty much every week, unless it's a really, really weird week. But in his opening discussion, after identifying who he is in verses 1 and 2, he jumps into a prayer of sorts, a praising of God. And in verse 3, this is what he says in his words to this church and his words to us. He says, "Blessed be God, the Father of our Lord Jesus, the Anointed One, who grants us every spiritual blessing in these heavenly realms where we live in the Anointed, not because of anything that we have done, but because of what he has done for us." Verse 4, God chose us to be in a relationship with him even before he laid out plans for this world. He wanted us to live holy lives, characterized by love, free from sin, and blameless before him. He destined us to be adopted as his children, the covenant Jesus the Anointed inaugurated in his sacrificial life. This was his pleasure and will for us. Now, there's a lot we can unpack there. There's a lot that we could do a deep dive in. But when I read this, the central core that I pull out here, and it kind of bookends it, is the idea, the concepts that we're going to focus on woven throughout this message is simple. It's that we are chosen. We are chosen. You are chosen. In a world where we're often, too often, I would say, valued for our talents or our looks, our skills, or our money, Paul is challenging the way that we see ourselves. You see, because most of us struggle because we're just people and we're cogs and we feel like we're cogs in a machine, we feel as though the world sees us as less. We see ourselves as not quite measuring up. Maybe we see ourselves as second class, as also-rans. We're the bench warmers while the stars are getting all the attention. We're always the bridesmaids and never the bride. And if we're honest, most of us see ourselves as hard to love, as challenging people, as people that put our foot in our mouths, as people that wish that we were better, or maybe we wish that we were different. And so we've come to identify ourselves as rejected or unloved or worthless. When I was a teenager, I remember struggling with this significantly. In fact, there was one relationship I had that could have been defined by this competition that I developed in my own mind, where I saw this other teenager in my youth group. His name was Adam. And I looked at him as though he was the chosen one. He, I felt, was a little more talented, at least a little more talented than I was. He was more popular than I was. He was better looking than I was. And I felt like the way that people looked at me was like, well, if Adam can't do this, we'll get Jordan to do this. And it's dumb in retrospect. It's one of those things that I look back and say, boy, was I stupid. And you'll find, if you're young, you'll find that there's going to be a lot of that in your life. But that doesn't discount the impact that that had. Because for years, I was bitter toward Adam for some reason, because it's as if he was the problem, as he was the source of my issues. If only Adam was out of the picture, I'd be number one. And I was bitter, I was jealous of him, of the opportunities I felt that he got. And so even though we were friends, we would not just drift apart, but we'd like push it into hyperdrive and just blow apart. And it was something that was difficult because the impact that that had on me wasn't just a matter of how I thought people in my church thought of me. But the impact that that had is I started to not just see myself as that in certain contexts, but I began to see myself like that in every context. To the point that I started to see myself and expect that God saw me how I saw me. As somebody that was the runner-up. As somebody that, sure, God loved me. In the way that, you know, parents always say that I love all my kids equally. And you know how that's always a lie? Because there's always those parents. I mean, not every parent, but let's be honest. There are some parents that it's like, you know, I mean, I've been a youth pastor for years. I've been a pastor for a decade now. There have been a few parents that I've been like, you might want to tone it down with the outward expression of love on the one kid because it's clear and your other kid feels it. That's how I always felt. Like, not from my parents, but just in life. I always felt like the kid that was loved, but not as much. And I felt like that was the way God saw me. God loved me. He died for me. I knew all this. I grew up in church. I had it in my brain that God loves us. But you know in life that it doesn't always manifest itself as equally with one another. And I always thought that that was what it was for me. And it took me years. In fact, I actually met up with Adam in my freshman year at Bethany Bible College. And we decided to kind of just have an open and frank conversation because we were both kind of tired of this back and forth. And so we grabbed coffee because some things never change. And we chatted about this and we were super honest. And I just said, you know, I've got to apologize first and foremost because I feel like I've always had a wall up towards you and I've always had this jealous streak of you. And I said, dude, this it's not on you. You are not the problem. This has been something I've struggled with and how I've internalized it and how I've treated you because of it. And what I found hilarious in this discussion was that he was blown away that I was saying any of this. Because he had the exact opposite thought all growing up, for years, almost a decade. He saw me in the same way that I saw him. And so the reason we could never really figure out a way to be friends is because we were both so intensely jealous of the other person and the way that we saw people treating them that we saw ourselves as second class to the other person that we thought were the first class people. It was one of probably the most messed up conversations that I've had because, in a good way though, because it's like, how did we go for years with this attitude toward each other and this assumption about what this meant for me? And even though it was a small conversation and we ended with we forgave, we prayed for each other, we parted ways, we didn't go to the same school. It's not like we were going to be best friends after that. But that was profound nonetheless for me. Because that caused me to start to rethink my history, to reevaluate how others may have seen me and to reevaluate how I saw myself and to question whether I was wrong for thinking that I was the one who was less than. Because I'd always thought that. I always felt like I was less desirable or less talented. I had less potential. I think less of me. And if I'm being real, that's something that I still struggle with from time to time. And this conversation really challenged me to reevaluate and to ask myself, is this how God sees me? Because to this point, at that point in my life, I was at Bible college, but I hadn't embraced God's calling on my life. I hadn't fully committed myself to serving him and to embracing life as a minister for him. I don't even know that I'd call myself a fully committed Christian, let alone somebody that was preparing to be a pastor. I assumed that I was unlovable, so I self-sabotaged a lot of my relationships, whether it was even just a platonic friendship, definitely romantically. I had not a great track record for that, though I'm grateful that I didn't end up in any kind of unfortunate or messed up relationships, because I got a good one out of that. So some things worked out for me in that regard. But I saw myself as untalented, and so I never put myself out there in ministry the way that I knew that God wanted me to. But being confronted by my identity and who I really was and being challenged that perhaps I wasn't who I thought I was made me embrace, perhaps for the first time, that there was something more. That God cared. But not just that, but that God had chosen me. That God had chosen me to be part of this relationship with him. That he chose me to be his child, that holy and deeply loved. That God chose me to use me to do more than I thought was possible. That God had gifted me to be a minister of the gospel and to be able to impact people for his kingdom. That God had chosen me to use me. That God pursued me. That God cared, and that God was willing and able and had given everything for me. And maybe for you, what you hear on a regular basis, you hear God loves you, which is true. Maybe you hear that God cares for you and God cares, and you hear this in a general sense, but you think, well, sure, he loves me, but I'm certainly not his favorite. Maybe for you, you have been so used to thinking of yourself in a certain way as second class, a second level of second best, or maybe even lower, that you even doubt that God would pursue you. There's a song that we sing that's called Reckless Love, and one of the lines that are in that song is talking about how God leaves the 99. And that actually finds its roots in a story that Jesus told in Luke 15, where he tells a story of a shepherd leaving his flock of 99 to pursue the one. And when I hear that story, and that's part of why I love the Reckless Love song, is because God puts himself in harm's way, even in a way that some may call foolish, risking everything for the one that he loves, not just the ones. But God has the supernatural ability to see each and every one of us and see us as the one who he would leave the rest of the flock so he would pursue you. That is the level of love that he has for you. You are the one sheep. You are the one who Christ pursues with abandon. You are chosen. Jesus uses another metaphor that he compares the kingdom of heaven, a Hebrew shorthand for God, to a jeweler pursuing, searching for the finest pearls. And Jesus, in Matthew 13, says, when he found a pearl more beautiful and valuable than any jewel he had ever seen, the jeweler sold all he had and bought the pearl, his pearl of great price. You are that pearl. You are the one that God gives everything for, who he sacrificed everything to get, who he extended his grace to. You are not just one of his children, but you are his chosen one, the one who he would have laid down his life for, even if you had been the only one on earth. You are God's chosen. You are highly valued. You are deeply loved. Perhaps there's no better image of God choosing the people that feel unworthy than in the story of his disciples. his closest core followers would have all been considered less than ideal. They would have been the wrong people to choose for a man like Jesus. In John 15, though, he reminds them, I don't call you servants any longer. Servants don't know what the master is doing, but I've told you everything the Father has said to me. I call you friends. You did not choose me. I chose you, and I orchestrated all of this so you would be sent out and bear great and perpetual fruit. You didn't choose me. I chose you. And earlier in his ministry, he says, if the Father who sent me does not draw you, there's no way that you can come to me. Often in church, we focus on our response to God's grace, on what we do, on the role that we have to play. You know, in a lot of my sermons, I try to give practical steps that you need to take, that we need to take in order to be faithful to God's calling on us. But in our efforts to do that, sometimes we make the gospel about us, about trying harder and being better. And sometimes we miss the level that God did. In that verse from Ephesians, he says, not because of anything that we have done, but because what he has done for us. It is certainly good that we focus on how we can be faithful to God, but sometimes we need to start with how does God see us and what has Christ already done? Because it all starts with Jesus. It all starts with what Jesus did for us that overflowed out of his identity of who he is and his great love. It's why Hebrews calls Jesus the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. Jesus' disciples, the people that were Jesus' chosen ones, the ones that he selected to be his closest companions, were not the kind of people that you would expect that he would choose. In fact, they would have been considered unqualified to follow Jesus, and yet Jesus chose them anyways. Peter and his brother Andrew, James and his brother John, probably the four most commonly known of Jesus' disciples, would not have been the kind of men that a person like Jesus would have called to follow him. For those of you that aren't familiar with first century Jewish culture, which my guess would be none of you, or at least very few, Jesus chose fishermen to follow him. Now, why that is odd is twofold. Jesus would have been considered a rabbi, which was a highly regarded career path in first century Israel. They were considered leaders. They were considered pioneers. They were considered trailblazers. They knew the scriptures, and they taught and they modeled what it meant to serve and follow God. And of course, in first century Israel, that was the pinnacle of their society. Everything in the lives of young men growing up were geared in the hopes that they could transcend their station. They could move beyond what their father had done and embrace a new life following a rabbi. So they worked hard. They memorized much of scripture in hopes that all of their hard work would pay off and they'd set themselves apart from their society and become a disciple of a rabbi. And Peter and Andrew and James and John were fishermen, which then would not have been a well-respected career. In fact, generally speaking, if you came from fisherman stock, you were considered to be relatively lowly. You weren't considered to be any kind of respectful person. And so Jesus encountering these men were important because what it says is that these men were told at some point that they weren't good enough to be a disciple of a rabbi. Pretty much anybody that wasn't a disciple of a rabbi, whether it's they were fishermen or like other people that Jesus called, they were a tax collector, they were people that weren't good enough. each and every person that Jesus called to follow him, he purposely chose because they weren't good enough. Because they would have been told by somebody in society that you don't measure up. But when he encountered Peter and Andrew and James and John, and he called them, he said, come and follow me. It sounds ridiculous. If you've read that, maybe you've wondered, why would these people drop everything and leave their families to go and follow this guy? Because Jesus that we think of wasn't the Jesus that they would have thought of. Because this is just a guy at this point. They didn't know. It's not like Jesus actually walked around with a halo on his head. Like, Jesus appeared just like any other dude. But what they would have known is he was a rabbi. And what they would have known is that to be chosen by a rabbi and to have the offer of come follow me meant that you were being chosen for greatness. When Jesus chose boys that didn't make the cut, he was saying something profound. You may not feel like you're enough. You may not see yourself as extraordinary, but Jesus looks at you and sees somebody that can be like him, that can do what he does. In fact, it's people like you that God uses to change the course of human history. Jesus consistently chose the wrong people to further his mission. He consistently chooses the broken, the beaten, the rebel, the thief, the liar, the forlorn, the has-been, the never-was, the failure, and the loser. And he does it on purpose because it declares over them and over you that this is not how God sees you. That you are so much more than your distorted image that you've developed. That you are more than you ever imagined. You are God's chosen. Paul tells his readers in Colossians 3:12, and he's telling you, you are God's chosen people. You are holy and dearly loved. This is how God sees you. It's quite unlike the way the world sees, and it's probably unlike the way that you see yourself. But this is the identity that he wants you to embrace. This is how God sees you, and this is how he wants you to see yourself. You may be used to seeing yourself as useless or used or unlovable or ugly or worthless or hated or dirty, but what God sees is someone holy and dearly loved. What God sees is someone worth dying for. And he's calling you to embrace who you really are and who he has called you to be. Because when you embrace who you really are, when you embrace your true identity, it changes everything. When you see how God sees, nothing will be the same, because when you embrace who you are, it changes what you do. And God wants you to see yourself as chosen, as highly valued, as dearly loved. And he's calling you to surrender the way you see yourself and the way you live your life to him. As the worship team comes at this time, we're going to close with a song of surrender. Because for many of us, we are struggling in this battlefield of identity, and we don't know how to change the way that we think, but the way to do that is not to try to be better and to become through your own actions and your own efforts to be better than you are. The Christian life is about surrender. It's about saying, God, I am willing to embrace who you say that I am, who you have called me to be, and I'm willing to say, God, I will be who you say that I am, and I will trust that I am who you say that I am. And so this morning, maybe you've been struggling with this idea of identity, of seeing yourself as valued and as seeing yourself as worth something. Today, God is giving you a chance to embrace who he's called you to be and to surrender years of self-doubt, to surrender and to lay down years of devaluing yourself or allowing others to devalue you, and instead to embrace a new life, a new identity, as somebody who is chosen, holy, and dearly loved. So if you'd like to stand with us, we're going to close with this song. It's called I Give You My Heart. It's a song of surrender. It's a song of commitment. And it just says, Lord, I give you my heart. I give you my soul, and I live for you alone. And maybe today, what you need to hear and what you need to do is simply as an act of surrender, whether it's standing where you're at, whether it's sitting where you're at. The altars are always open. You can come and sit at an empty seat. You can kneel at the altar. But perhaps what you need today is to surrender and embrace who God is calling you to be.